Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does talking about food contribute to the pleasure we take in cooking, eating, and sharing it? It is almost impossible to sit down to a great meal without remarking on it to our dining companions. And my guest believes the act of conversing about food not only elevates our delight, but also reveals a great deal about our shared culture and about the relationship of American food to the broader world. Priscilla Parkhurst-Ferguson is professor in the Department of Sociology at Columbia University, and she is author of the new book, Word of Mouth, What We Talk About When We Talk About Food. Priscilla, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
This book made me think not only of how we talk about food, but how often. This is something that just about all of us, we do it every single day.
Absolutely. And part of the reason is, you know, eating is such a very private concern. The only way we can share our food, unless we're a mother of a baby bird, is by talking about it. And this talking about what we eat creates a community, sometimes a good one, hopefully a good one, and sometimes not, but it creates bonds between people.
And discussions of food in literature and art, interestingly, are almost never about the food itself.
That changes somewhat in the, say, the 19th century. But for a long time, the food itself was considered, it was funny, it was burlesque, and also too much on food was, in some circles, considered sinful. It was considered gluttony, and so therefore one didn't talk about it.
You open the book with lyrics from the song, the mid-60s song, Bread and Butter. Let's listen to that for a minute, and then we'll talk about it.
Oh, great.
Okay, that was the New Beats, 1964, Bread and Butter. You say that song is archetypal food talk. How so?
Well, I discovered it quite by accident. My husband said he knew there was a song someplace about mashed potatoes. And, well, this is an anti-mashed potatoes song. But it turns out that for what I call food talk, it tells one story, but it tells another story underneath that. In other words, what food is used for. And here it tells a story of a love gone wrong because of the wrong food. So the sort of the intimate connection between what one eats and what one is and or does in life.
So when you want to write about the ways we talk about food in this culture, or communicate about food, where did you look for primary sources of that dialogue?
Well, all over the place, in popular culture, in a lot on newspaper articles. YouTube is a marvelous resource. That's how I found Bread and Butter. Cartoons. Much of the food talk is not labeled as such, but it's all the ways that food is talked about in our culture. And so films, I spend a lot of time on films because I think they're really films I use are really wonderful examples of the kinds of things I'm talking about. They dramatize the food talk. So Ratatouille is in the epilogue, and then I have a South Korean film called, in English, Le Grand Chef, about competitive cooking, and a French film called, in English, Haute Cuisine. So a lot of it is serendipity, sort of what comes up. Once I started working on food, people start sending me examples of things all over the place. So finding examples and so forth is not a problem.
Have you noticed our food talk in the United States evolving as a greater diversity of cultures and even ingredients are available to us to eat?
Oh, absolutely. In my town upstate where we... or my family home, there are things sold in the supermarket. Supermarket's called Price Chopper. It's not an upscale, particularly supermarket, but it sells organic food. They didn't know from organic 15, 20 years ago in any case. So, yes, the availability of foodstuffs, and in a place where I am in New York, in large cities, you've got an immense amount of foods available that no one, well, very few people had even heard of 25 years ago.
And it is interesting the way foods that start out exotic, at least to us Americans, become normalized so quickly, to the extent that, you know, you mentioned organic food in Price Chopper. I think you can walk into a 7-Eleven, a convenience store here, and find, like, right, hummus and pita, which is something that used to be reserved to a very specific kind of ethnic food restaurant.
Or take, for example, coffee. You know, you can order a macchiato, a latte. It's part of the lingo, which pre-Starbucks, it was very, very limited to a small range of people who had, say, been to Italy and knew what a macchiato was. But now cappuccino, it's a cappuccinization of America, I think.
And we, it's funny because the moment that we embrace these new foods, it's as if we've always loved them, right? We can't remember the time before we had to have a cappuccino or our day wouldn't start.
Yeah, I had a quiche on the way to the studio this afternoon. Now, quiche was a particular French specialty, and now quiche is all over the place, all over the United States. And it's a kind of food that fits well into an American on an American palate. So that certainly helps. But that's also true for any culture, that it, something like couscous in France started out being North African, and now couscous is absolutely everywhere in France.
You pay particular attention in the book to the relationship between French and American food cultures. First of all, let's start with the French. How did they make fine food such a key component of their national identity?
Well, in the 17th century, and you do have to go back to the 17th century, it was very much part of a policy that sent French chefs abroad, that had a number of cookbooks. And in the cookbooks, there are things saying, in France, we do things better. And that's food. It's everything else we do. This is the epitome of civilization. In the 19th century, with the expansion of the restaurant, this became institutionalized. So there were sort of elite connections, because in the 17th and 18th century, it was members of the court. In the 19th century, it was restaurateurs, but it had those elite associations. So they were connected to this sense of French national identity. This was, after all, the 19th century, where nationalism was going strong. Not only in France, either.
Well, yeah, what's so fascinating about that, and I don't think anybody would dispute that French cuisine can be amazing, but they just did a really good job of aggressively exporting their ideas about the fact that they had the best food in the world.
You are absolutely right.
To the rest of the world.
Yes, and everyone else, and even more amazing is everybody believed them. the whole notion of French cuisine as something that's unlike anything else is totally false, but they've done a marvelous marketing job since the mid-17th century.
And to this day, many terms used, certainly in professional kitchens, but even in home kitchens, they're French words, but there's no particular reason why they wouldn't be put into the lingua franca.
Yes, and you'll find in cookbooks, even, say, Fanny Farmer's cookbook of 1896 or Irma Rombauer in 1931, there are a whole slew of French terms, and they're just assumed, and even given more or less French spellings, more or less assumed that everybody knows what they are. And that's part of the fact that French cuisine is so codified, classic French cuisine, that you learn these basic techniques and then you could go on and do whatever you wanted.
Yeah, you have to start by knowing the rules and then you can expand
right
from there.
Right.
How have people down through the ages acknowledged that food can be spoiled, food can be poisoned, that this thing that is very familiar and comforting also poses a risk every time we open our mouths?
That's why I have a chapter on food fears. And everyone is fearful, whether they know it or not. And in some ways, every time you put a fork or a spoon in your mouth, you are putting your life on the line. Now, it's absolutely crucial that we not think that, otherwise we'll never eat anything, which is, of course, not an optimal situation. So the food fears are important. Now, what's interesting is how those food fears have changed over decades, over centuries. In the Middle Ages, it was important to see a healthy cow to know that your meat was going to be healthy. You had to see the... Whereas now, we haven't... Who sees a cow? No one sees a cow. We have other safeguards, but there is greater and greater distance from the food. How do we know that salmonella is or is not in an egg? We don't. And often that's after the fact we find out.
And of
which
course...
Which is why you have these recalls, probably recalling many millions of eggs that are not contaminated, but just on the chance that one more might be.
So it's almost an act of faith for us these days.
It is an act of faith. And it's because we anticipate pleasure, and that anticipation outweighs the fears that we have that something might not be just right. I mean, I'm allergic to peanuts, and, you know, I think about it all the time, and sometimes I take chances I probably shouldn't take.
How do you handle, you know, so many people now are coping with food allergies. At least we weren't as aware of them, you know, a generation or two ago. There are people who I would imagine you say, I have an allergy, and they're very respectful and very careful. And other people who say, oh, that lady's so much trouble and it's all in her head. I mean, I wonder how you negotiate that through your language when you need to keep yourself safe in a restaurant.
You just simply have to insist on it. Restaurants today in America are really quite good on this because there have been a lot of incidents that have been highly publicized. Elsewhere, it's rather less prominent a feature. Upscale, very fine restaurants will do it. But it's the first word I learn in any foreign language is peanuts.
So that you can double check that they're not there.
Right.
Yeah.
And of course, even then, they don't always know. I mean, you know, well, they're not peanuts, but then they're something else in there that I'm allergic to. It's a negotiation.
It's interesting, Priscilla, in our culture, there are certain kinds of restaurants where we walk in and we expect to be able to say exactly what we want and be given exactly what we want. Mm-hmm. And then there are other situations where we sort of back off and feel like we're lucky that the chef has deigned to cook for us and we really shouldn't make any suggestions.
Well, that's the what chefs, the celebrity chefs, have convinced us of, that their tasting menus, for example, take away initiative. I mean, the great innovation of the restaurant in the 19th century was choice. There was a menu, and you could choose from the menu, as opposed to being in someone's home when you take what people, what your host sets before you. So that choice is being taken away by the chef, well-known chef, who says, "Well, you should have confidence in me." So it's this promotion of the chef into a personality. And a creative artist that has made this this possible. And it's a question of how much you can negotiate with a top chef, for example. It's not unnegotiable. They will take allergies into account, for example.
We're speaking this hour with Priscilla Parkhurst Ferguson. She's professor in the Department of Sociology at Columbia University and author of the new book, Word of Mouth, What We Talk About When We Talk About Food. If you would like to talk with us about food, you can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is sociologist Priscilla Parkhurst Ferguson. She is a professor at Columbia University and author of the book Word of Mouth, What We Talk About When We Talk About Food. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. It would also seem, Priscilla, that we communicate something about ourselves when we eat, not least of which is what our social class probably is, depending on not just where we might go to eat, but what we might choose when we get there.
Absolutely. And people have consciously or unconsciously coded the what one eats with a particular background. I mean, novels are full of scenes of showing insiders and outsiders. Or one of my favorite examples is from the film Titanic, where the guy, hero from steerage, ends up dining in first class, and all his mistakes. Downton Abbey is full of things like that as well. It's a great series just for the kitchens and the food.
And interestingly, in Downton Abbey, the characters who are preparing the food, who are of a much lower social class than their employers, they know all the rules, and they will equally judge these higher class people who make a mistake.
That's right. One of the really interesting things in Downton Abbey, not only for the food but for others, is how the lesser people, the people below stairs, judge almost from the point of view of the people upstairs, of who makes it or not, and without any sense of themselves being part of that world or except in an ancillary way.
It's remarkable that although hunger still exists, certainly in this country and without question globally, our talk about food and our discussions about the problem of hunger seem very far apart from one another.
They are, and there is a push in, say, the gastronomic version of food talk to emphasize sustainability, for example, that we must eat responsibly and so forth. So the ethical aspect of consumption to be tied to what, in fact, we eat on our own. Someone like Michael Pollan, who's written very popular books, is an example to a certain extent, of this attitude. Mark Bittman, who writes cookbooks but also writes The New York Times, is a bit preachy for my taste. But that's certainly an important way of trying to bridge the gap between the needs of the larger society and the presentation, the contributions of this really exquisite cuisine in many cases.
Of course, it's always a challenge in any era to decide what is sustainable and what is healthful. There are usually like 10 different camps telling you we have the right way to eat. Don't listen to those guys.
Absolutely. And so I tend to say, well, if it's good, it must be good for you. But it's not just a way of opting out. It's a way of coping, because there are so many choices. There are so many studies about kale. Kale chips seem to be absolutely everywhere these days. But no one really knows, and it's partially an act of faith. Vegetables are good, sure, but is kale really going to do all that for you? Let me see a really great study on that.
How do we talk about overeating in this country?
One way to talk about it is the obesity, quote-unquote, epidemic. What does that mean? How is that tied to social class? How is that comes up with the issue of school lunches, for example? Should not more healthful food be part of school lunches? Well, but what if the kids don't eat the healthful food? So there we are. Again, it comes down to the individual choice against social aims. And you may have, those of you who heard that ex-Mayor Bloomberg of New York wanted to limit the size of sodas sold in New York, and the uproar of individual taste against this draconian request or requirement of healthful food. So I found that people resist any way of confining their taste. It's theirs, and therefore it's good. I always say there's no arguing about taste. Well, there is, in fact, a great deal of arguing about taste.
You were talking about, you know, when we talk about overeating, and we can frame that in terms of the obesity crisis. What's very interesting to me in terms of the differences from, say, a century ago, we once frowned upon gluttony for its own sake, right? Eating more than you need was just something that was considered a sin and sort of wasteful. Now, I think we almost laugh at people who can eat whatever they want but do not become overweight or obese. They get a pass for gluttony, whereas overweight people who may not, in fact, be gluttons are harshly judged in our society.
Well, gluttony, as defined by the Catholic Church in any case, is when your appetite, your desire, overwhelms your control. Many of the people who overeat are perfectly in control. I'll take the example of competitive eating, which is an enormous phenomenon these days in the United States with international rankings and so forth. The most well-known example is the hot dog eating contest every 4th of July at Coney Island, sponsored by Nathan's. The person who, the competitors, are totally in control, not particularly overweight. The leading woman weighs, I don't know, 105 or something like that. And they talk about training. So that's not gluttony, it's overeating. But it's presented as a sport. So that's one way of getting around gluttony. And take Thanksgiving. It's ritualized overeating. You are pushed to overeat. You can't, you're going to take your mother's sweet potato, or you're going to take your great aunt Betty's regular mashed potatoes. Well, what do? You take both.
You can't hurt anyone's feelings, right?
Right. Is you're going to take the mince pie or the pumpkin pie. We're going to take both because that's sort of the spirit of Thanksgiving.
Is that uniquely American? Because there are other cultures that have feasts at certain times of year.
Other cultures certainly have feasts. The discourse of overeating and not gluttony, but abundance, I don't know if it's unique, but it certainly is characteristic of the United States, that immigrants coming to the United States saw a land of abundance. And so eating that abundance, consuming that abundance, showed you were an American, showed you were patriotic. Go back. So, and that, there's no other country that I know of that has a national meal in the way that we have Thanksgiving, which, remember, has to be declared every year by the president in early November.
When he pardons the turkey, Thanksgiving is also declared.
Yeah, well, pardoning turkey is very late. I mean, it's only, I think, George Bush was the first person to pardon a turkey. And Thanksgiving itself as an official holiday only dates from President Lincoln.
One thing that's always interesting that, you know, certainly people who come from other countries will go to many American restaurants and comment on the amount of food. But it seems like that's another part of the dialogue, even within the United States. And particularly if you eat at certain kinds of restaurants, you can't help but comment on the portion size. And the first thing you say when the plate is laid in front of you in a restaurant is, oh, my goodness, I can't possibly eat all that.
Right. Right. That has been the case for a long time. Fortunately, they've had the invention of the doggy bag, although often if you're in a nice restaurant, you sort of think, well, is this really a doggy bag type place?
Oh, I'm not shy. I take the doggy bag.
Oh, absolutely, whenever you can. But it's a question of whether they're equipped to do it. And if it's a really fancy dish, does it transport? If you're having, you know, lasagna from your local pizza parlor, that's something else again. But the copiousness of things is, again, it's part of what Americans like to see is their generosity, the abundance that I talked about before. It all sort of fits together. Cultures that have had to deal more with war and penury and even famine, are more moderate.
And I suppose in exchange for that generosity, we sacrifice a certain amount of meticulousness about preparation, right? We are not spending 45 minutes sculpting a radish into something extraordinary. We want to get that thing diced and on a plate so that we can put it in a giant salad.
Right. But that's, again, it's the problem of the home cook, domestic cook, who doesn't do roses. But it's also something you expect, radish roses, in a fancy restaurant. It's part of the, you can say it's non-food or it's food as decor, which we don't do in the domestic setting.
What is the difference between our expectations when we eat out as opposed to eating at home? And have those expectations changed given that so many of us eat a larger proportion of meals away from home now than we did a generation ago?
Right. The eating out used to be a special occasion. Mm-hmm. You would eat out and you left home. You often dressed up, not always. Partially the spreading of fast food outlets has changed that. Eating out is, you know, if you go to McDonald's, it's sort of an extension of home. It's not a special occasion. And in lands of takeout, home deliveries, well, are you eating out or are you eating in? Even if you're eating at your home, you're not preparing food. So the lines between the two blur a great deal. To a certain occasion, you know, meals may be, if you're having a dinner, some part of the meal may come from elsewhere. Some ingredients maybe. How much, you know, in New York, in any case, reheating something in the microwave is considered cooking. So there are a lot more opportunities with food outlets so that the eating out and the eating in changes, which means that even when eating out in a, quote, nice or fancy restaurant, more and more, especially the younger generation, is saying, I'm not going to get dressed up. I want it to be informal, sort of smart, casual is the watchword. So often very inventive cuisine, but in a very informal setting.
What is the difference between haute cuisine and haute food as you see it?
Well, haute cuisine is the term applied to the codified French cuisine that evolved largely in the 19th century. Often people say what they like about French cuisine is that, you know, their techniques, you learn the techniques and, you know, how everything fits together, sort of. If you learn this sauce, then you just add something for another sauce. So you learn how to make a hollandaise, you're halfway to a béarnaise sauce and so on. That's haute cuisine. It's associated with fancy dishes, expensive dishes, things of, extreme expense. Haute food is where the emphasis is entirely on the food as opposed to the social setting or the meal. So that you would be looking at odd things going together, so that Wendy's had a promotion. It was in Japan, but still a promotion of foie gras and caviar on a hamburger, or lobster with a hamburger. So having luxury ingredients in a definitely non-luxury setting. So anything, what I call over-attention to food, because I think the main unit is the meal, means that you're focusing on one element of a meal as opposed to the whole.
Do you think that our constant expectation when we're eating out that we will get something new and surprising, some combination of flavors we've never considered before, does that relate at all to the pace of, like, the media cycle and the speed with which information is made available to us these days?
Well, the speed at which information is made available is the proliferation of blogs, say like Yelp and other sites, that tell you about the latest thing that it has here. So it has very much it's like fashion. You get the latest fashion. And it also means that the competition is extraordinary because you've got a new thing this week. Well, what are you going to do for me next week? And so how do you choose them? I mean, on the other hand, they're the people who want the old favorites. And a number of the chefs I interviewed now 22 years ago said that there's some things they could never take off the menu because they'd have a revolt for their regular customers. On the other hand, they have to have a menu that will also have new things. So it's juggling the new and the old. Running a restaurant is not easy.
How does professional food communication and writing differ from the kinds of conversations that regular people have about food?
Well, professional writing is geared toward a particular audience with presumably a particular aim, so that your reviews in newspapers about restaurants, it's a particular view. When you're talking with your friends, it's probably much less analytic. You're going to say, I liked it, or I didn't like it, or you're probably not going to go into details about there was too much salt and then the oregano was really light and then so forth. So, because most people don't have the professional vocabulary to make that kind of analysis.
So we don't have
probably
to just
as well.
Yeah, we don't have to justify it with our friends depending on what we like or don't like.
Mm-hmm. Right, you say I like it or I don't like it.
My guest is Priscilla Parkhurst Ferguson. She's professor in the Department of Sociology at Columbia University. She has a new book out as well. It's called Word of Mouth, What We Talk About When We Talk About Food. We'll resume this conversation in a few minutes. If you'd like to be part of it by telling us a story, maybe talking about how you communicate about food, or if you'd like to ask a question, you can do that by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to the show at think@kera.org. Or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
What is this? Keep your station clear. When the rush comes, what will happen? Messy station, slow kicks down. Food doesn't go, others pile up, disaster. I'll make this easy to remember. Keep your station clear, or I will kill you! How do you tell how good bread is without tasting it? Not the smell, not the look, but the sound, the crust. Listen. Oh, a symphony of crackle. Only great bread sound this way.
That is a scene from the animated film Ratatouille. My guest this hour is Priscilla Parkhurst Ferguson. She's professor in the Department of Sociology at Columbia University and author of the book Word of Mouth, What We Talk About When We Talk About Food. Priscilla, I know that you're particularly fond of this little film, and it's a great example of our desire to connect with food on an emotional level and not only on a sensory level.
Absolutely. The emotions in there, you have Colette teaching Remy trying to teach Linguini about how to use knives and so forth. But she invests very much of herself. She said, you know, look around. Is there any women in this kitchen? No, she's the only one. Why am I here? It's because I have to be better. I work harder and so forth. So it's her emotional investment is there. But then with the food, the critic tasting the food, being transported back to his childhood and so forth, it's the sensory leads to the emotional in a very, in a sense, moving scene. And you see him at the end of the film, totally transformed. He's wearing a beret and eating in the bistro now called Ratatouille, and just says, surprised me. He's totally happy with, he has changed character. He had been the most acerbic, sort of nasty critic in Paris and so forth.
What's wonderful about that scene where he eats this ratatouille, which for people who don't know, it's sort of a peasant vegetable dish. The scene in which he's taken back to his childhood is all accomplished with no words whatsoever. There's no dialogue. We simply see him in his mother's kitchen, and she sort of, chucks him on the chin and ruffles his hair. And it's fascinating that we can all relate. I suppose it's not speech, but it's visual imagery that everyone can understand what's taking place.
Yes, and take the other scene when Remy and his brother, Emile, have had the lightning strike, the mushroom and cheese, and they're trying to, or Remy's trying to decide how to talk about it. And what you see are all kinds of whirligigs in the background and music. In other words, two other senses brought to bear to translate what you cannot talk about.
Is there reason to believe that we talk about food more today than we did in the past, when it was really just about getting enough calories into people's mouths to live through another night?
Well, there have always been great food talkers. Probably the greatest food talker of all time is a 3rd century Greek living in Rome, who has this vast amount of stuff, things that I thought were modern, in fact, turn up there. But we have many more outlets of talking about food. People write memoirs. There are the blogs that I mentioned before. Every restaurant has a website of some sort, some very elaborate. The chefs in these restaurants often write cookbooks. In other words, there really is an explosion over the past 25 years or so. Especially add television and add the social media. When I want to figure out for a recipe, what do? I have a fish, or I'll go on the net and see what I can find for black bass tonight. And I think we all do that. And that is a kind of food talk, especially in many of those outlets. You will have someone giving a recipe, and then you'll have people writing in and say, well, I substituted this and did that, and I really didn't like it such and such. And so it becomes part of a conversation. Now, that conversation would have gone on in the kitchen between your mother, your grandmother, and your aunt, but now it's sort of out there for all to see, use, consult, or complain about, as the case may be.
That's occurred to me when I've looked for recipes, like on Epicurious or something. And at the bottom, after the recipe, 85 people have made it. And somebody says, yes, it's much better if you use twice the salt, but don't use so much broth. Right. And everybody has their own interpretation, as if you had neighbors around.
As if you had neighbors around. And it's also people saying, well, this is how I do it. It's an expression of your individuality, of you are creating something, you're not just reproducing. And, recipes are orders, as it were, but that's to reproduce something. But in fact, you make a twist. And my husband will often say to me, well, what did you do to this one and what are we going to call it? And I say, no, I don't know.
You have to have a name for it to count.
You have to have a name for it, and that's also a genius of the French, to give a name to everything. You have two sauces that barely differ, and one has one name and one has another name. And it's certainly easier if you want to get Hollandaise or Béarnaise. You've got it in Ted, whereas you've got, what I did for the last 4th of July doesn't really help you that much.
Was the genius of Julia Child that she took this really complicated, pretty regimented way of cooking and then went into it with an attitude that was both serious but also not serious about herself? Is that why she worked on television?
Well, Julia Child had an amazing personality, as anyone who's watched her stuff. I particularly like the interview that I cite with David Letterman when she makes the stove doesn't work, so she has to make steak tartare on a hamburger. And, and David Letterman goes bonkers. But what she does is take this cuisine and with a very American attitude, you can do it. And it was her translation into American kitchen, domestic kitchens. French cuisine had been presented in fancy restaurants for, a long time. but this was left made for the pretty much average middle-class American kitchen. And it said also, it was very liberating, it said also, enjoy food, enjoy cooking. Even before that, Irma Rombauer's cookbook is extraordinary. The joy of cooking, not the joy of eating, not the joy of food, but the joy of cooking. In other words, turning the domestic cook into a, quote, real cook or someone who takes pleasure in what she's doing. So it's not until the women started doing this kind of cooking that French cuisine sort of filtered down into popular culture. And on television, she, you know, the fact that she was oversized and she had this really weird voice, it wouldn't have worked 10 years before, and it wouldn't have worked 10 years after. It was a particular level of sophistication, minimal sophistication, because she spoke to people, I think, who already knew something about French food. I first discovered it, I was in Paris as a student, and a recipe for béarnaise sauce appeared in the Herald Tribune, and I made it, and all of a sudden I started saving money, because before, if I wanted béarnaise sauce, I had to go to a local restaurant and spend a lot more money.
You know, food television, food writing, I find it fascinating because there aren't too many other sensory experiences that we would prefer to have them in person, but we're pretty content to watch now, you know, the Food Network or the food shows on PBS. It's not fun to read about a painting, right? It's not fun very often to read about a ball game, but there's something about descriptions of food or even watching other people eating that satisfies us.
Yes, watching people eat, partially it's there I go, maybe I could do that too. But it's a way of coming to terms with your food universe, expanding your food universe. I can't tell you the number of students I had say, oh, I want to be a food writer. No, they really don't have a clue what that means and what it would entail, because you do have to know some basic things before you start just writing about food. But because food is hard to describe, we like to see how people try to do it. I mean, how many metaphors, how lush is your food writing? It's a very hard genre. One person I talk about in the book is M.F.K. Fisher, who ties the writing about foods to writing about a whole culture.
Talk about this. We also have different ways of expressing ourselves through what we eat. And you write about the phenomenon of vegetarians and once a week vegetarians and pescatarians. There are so many different ways that we now define ourselves according to what we will or will not eat, and separate and apart typically from restrictions based on allergies or intolerances.
Well, yes, it's what I call culinary individualism. Makes this a point that you are what you eat, you are what you become what you eat, and you eat what you hope to be. And so it's a way of defining yourself. You can say, I'm a vegetarian, but as you point out, that doesn't really tell you too much these days. There are too many varieties of vegetarian, but the examples that I give, they're very much tied to who these individuals are and how they define particular social relationships.
Do you have a favorite food movie?
Probably Babette's Feast.
Why?
Because it is emotionally fulfilling. It is beautifully filmed. Also, side thing, you see her learning Danish, and it's the way I taught French language for many, many years, and it's a very familiar exercise. It's the transcendent possibilities of consumption, and the difference between the 11 people at table, well, 10 of the villagers, who have no idea what they're eating. It's sort of simple pleasure, but they don't know what it is. Whereas the general, who knows what's going on, it is he who articulates what this pleasure is and what it means. And it's a beautiful film. Ratatouille is a great film, and probably a lot easier, certainly easier to teach. And Ratatouille is very much about the individual creator. And so Babette is a very complex film.
It's an interesting convention of food cinema and food literature that typically the characters who truly care and are passionate about creating really good food and choosing the finest ingredients, they come along with some automatic good qualities that we just assume about them. If they care this much about their food, they must not be such a bad person.
One of the chefs I interviewed in New York, when I asked him, is there anything I'd forgotten in the interview, and he said, well, one thing you have to understand, the most important quality for a chef is generosity. You have to be generous. You have to want to make people happy. And I think that point speaks to what you are saying. Now, often in the kitchen, someone like Gordon Ramsay will yell and scream at people, but it's the difference between the point of view of the people in the kitchen and the point of view of the customer.
Do you still watch that sort of food TV when you're not researching for a book, or do you find it offensive?
I don't like it. It's just not my relationship to food. Although it certainly is interesting how the proliferation of kinds of shows that some are on for professionals, and then we're going to start a restaurant and so on. It's interesting in the abstract, but I don't really like to watch it.
I suppose as a diner, as a consumer of food, if you even have in the back of your mind that sort of chaos is taking place, it doesn't help you digest your meal and enjoy it to the fullest.
Well, insofar as you keep production invisible, which it traditionally was, there was the kitchen and then there was the barrier into the room. The best example of this is George Orwell's Down and Out in Paris and London, where he talks about working in the kitchen and, you know, the magic transformation when the waiter goes into the dining room. But the invisibility of production, of cooking, was standard. What's happened with the celebrity chefs is that its production has become visible either through open kitchens, but then also through all the writing that the chefs end up doing, cookbooks, interviews, tours, good heaven, who knows what.
The mystery is gone.
Somewhat, the mystery is gone. It doesn't mean that the diner who buys the book is going to be able much to do it, but there's an effort at explanation for that.
Priscilla Parkhurst Ferguson is professor in the Department of Sociology at Columbia University and author of Word of Mouth, What We Talk About When We Talk About Food. Priscilla, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Well, thank you for having me, and it's always fun to talk about food, too. I should remember that.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Addie Sun. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.